The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Listening to another episode of Audio of Interest, coming to you on your portable media device or computer through the program feeds of the FlyPod.com New Media Network. I am your host, Gary Puckett, and we thank you for joining us today. Today's episode of Audio of Interest is brought to you by PuzzleFunds.org. If you are a community organization looking to raise money in a very unique way, check out their website, PuzzleFunds.org. Today, my guests are Kim Pham and his daughter, Rebecca Pham Yoxheimer. Kim was a first lieutenant in the South Vietnamese Air Force during the Vietnam War and flew C-130A cargo missions out of Tan Son Nhuc Air Base, located in Saigon, in the then Republic of South Vietnam. In 1975, their enemy, the North Vietnamese Army, advanced south, and the fall of South Vietnam was imminent. Our topic today is Kim Pham's story of escape for he and his family. As his story unfolds, I'd like you to place yourself in his shoes as a 27-year-old father who planned and carried out his family's escape to safety and eventually what became a much better life here in America.
Kim, Becca, it is indeed my pleasure to have you both joining me today.
Yes. Thank you for having us.
You are quite welcome. It is my understanding the C-130A airplane was kind of a workhorse aircraft during the Vietnam War.
Yes, yes.
And it was a four-engine propeller-driven airplane?
Yeah, turboprop.
Turboprop. It was also a very loud airplane, I'm told. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, yes, yes.
When you would fly a mission within the country, the Air Force Command would only fill your plane's fuel tank with enough fuel to make it to and from your destination. Is that true?
At that time, but before it's not. Before it's like a full tank or anywhere we fly in a full tank. But during that period of time, like when U.S. Military withdrawal, the equipment and their people, and the Air Force start to rationing the fuel.
Was it because of shortage of fuel, or they were both afraid people would?
Both. But the main thing, they're afraid that people were stealing the airplane to get out.
Yes.
The main thing, but they didn't say that, but we all understood.
Yeah, everybody knew.
Yes.
Let me ask you a kind of a personal question, but how was your quality of life like for you and your family living in Saigon at that time?
If compared with most people, my family was like not real wealthy, but we above average. We not poor or, you know, truck or daily. No, we okay for the living.
You had what you needed.
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right.
As the war really began changing, I should say the war effort, I suppose, began changing in 1975, can you explain how you started planning or even thinking out your family's escape from Vietnam?
Well, I've flown so many evacuated people from different airport to the safety, and I saw the chaos happen. And I thought, if this happened in Saigon, how I get my family out? Because my father, pastor, my in-law, also pastor, and they don't fight or, you know, crush people like to look for the good seat in the airplane. You know, you have to fight. Sure. Like a crowd, they don't care anymore. Just jump in and save their life. And I said, no way my family can do that, just like the other people. So I had to do something. And I had to think how to get out. But I didn't know how. Until the last minute, thing happened smoothly, more than I expect.
Tell me more about the plan.
Well, I asked a friend of mine, because I'm just co-pilot. I don't have any authority to take any airplane by myself. He is the major, but different airport, friend of mine. And he had the same idea just like me. He wanted to get out too, but he don't have anybody. Until I approaching him, I asked him, can you, because our family know him since a wee baby. So he said, yeah, whatever you plan, I go along with, you know. So I say, okay, I take care of that part. And then he say, whatever you and we plan, I go along with, seem like a good idea, but don't tell anybody, because if the minute they leak out, you and me go to jail and sit there forever, you know.
It's good to have friends, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, were there times when you thought about the consequences of being caught at this?
I never think about that. Never. Not in my mind. Get caught. Even you go forward, no backward.
That makes sense.
Yes.
So it becomes a mental attitude.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know if my friend nervous, but me. It's not. I'm not just 46 years later sit here and say, I'm not nervous. No. It's happened from the day one when I planned it until now, 46 years later. People ask me, I will answer the same thing.
Describe for me what was going through your mind as you were on the runway and you were loaded and you were ready to go. What happened? What transpired? Were there any negative things that happened? Any dangerous things that happened?
The thing is, I don't have any negative thing. I say anything I do, something had to be success, you know. Cannot be let anything else just bother me. Because the minute you're nervous, everything will change. You never know what's going on.
Were there any people who challenged you and tried to stop you maybe?
No, not at all. Because they don't know what's going on. The thing is, the major had the aircraft, and his mission, not my mission, to carry 20,000 pounds from Tunsinu to Phang Rang, like 150 miles away, to drop the supply there and then carry the passenger refugee back to Saigon. That was his mission. But because his mission was the aircraft on his squadron was broken, so his squadron came to my squadron and borrowed the airplane from my squadron. That is the one, the key right there. But if his aircraft and I jump over, fly with him, the aircraft don't have fuel. The fuel just enough to fly 150 miles out, 150 miles back. That's it. But my aircraft that day, by some reason, I don't know, the fuel is full. I don't know why it's full, but when I show up the aircraft, the fueler came to me. But he thought I was flying that aircraft, so he saw me. He get turned pale, and he said, Lieutenant, I take the smoke break. I forgot to turn off the fuel. Can I defuel? I said, no, you get out of here now. Please don't report me. Oh, sure. You know? But I give him a stunned look, just like I very angry, but it's not. You know, my heart is.
Not really.
Yeah, full. Because the minute I turn off the master switch, I saw the fuel is full.
Do you believe in miracles?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think one happened that day.
Why his aircraft broken? If his aircraft not broken, I never make it out of Vietnam.
Right. So things lined up. Just right.
Yes. Okay. Now, when they load up the aircraft, I jump to the cockpit of my airplane, my squadron airplane. So his crew, his co-pilot, is friend of mine. We are the same class. And I tell him that, hey, the flight from here to Phang Rang is 21 minutes. We drop off, take people back, and it's 21 minutes. Why you just let me fly and you go home? No. We do that inside my squadron. That's okay. But this is me, is the different, you know, bird in this, in the case, and how the all the other bird in the case except me. But they didn't know what going on because that happened all the time. You can, if you buzz, you can ask, hey, fly for me and I will fly for you tomorrow.
Sure.
So he said, okay. So he jumped. But I tell him that from here, from this aircraft, you take your back and go to take your more bike and go home. Don't go inside squadron. People be ask you, why are you here? Why don't you supposed to go to Phang Rang Airport? Now you're here. Don't let people ask you any questions. Just go home. He said, okay, sure.
So how did you arrange to have your family be there?
I told my parent, my brother, like a day early. I say, I want to get out of Vietnam as soon as I can because I cannot wait. Look, American people took off, and we don't have any bullet don't have spare part, any fuel to fly fighter, helicopter, everything is rationing, including C-130. So I asked my brother and mother, just prepare anytime if they hear from me. But before that, I already had the meeting at my home with a friend of mine, my brother, and I briefing them. I say, I will land at that remote long time, okay? Because we initially want to land at Vung Tau, it's bigger airport, bigger city. But at that time, so many refugees from the center of Vietnam came to Vung Tau by the 200,000 people. So if I land there, may not be successful. And then my brother, younger, he's teaching in the military school out there, English. So we may land and pick him up. But it won't work because how he get to the airport by himself and how do he know what aircraft to jump in. So I say, okay, let's land at Long Thanh Airport. That there, nobody control, nobody know what is that, you know? So I tell my brother, two pilots, and I tell them, if you hear from me, the minute you hear from me, leave home right away and go to Long Thanh Airfield and wait for me there. I will land there, pick you up, and fly to Singapore, all right? But I didn't tell them Singapore. So we get out of the country. That's what we do. Even the major flew with me. He didn't know where I'm going. I already planned. I draw the chart the night before. My wife looked at me and said, why don't you sleep? Is it too late now? You sit there and play with your chart. Say, no, I had to draw the line. I had to calculate the timing and fuel, whatever. You know, so the major who flew with me, he have only his headset. That's it. All he got. Normally you fly, you bring your flight equipment, chart, and flashlight, but he walked the airplane by himself, just like headset, just like you wear it. Now, it's funny, this part. The two loadmaster, different squadron, the flying engineer sit in the cockpit with us. They know me, but this guy is not in our squadron, why he fly? But he hears that I talk to my friend, and he said, okay. 21 minutes, what the heck? He can fly. And then this guy can go home. So they have no doubt what's going on. They don't know any clue to tell them that I was activate my plane the minute we start the engine, you know. So we back up the airplane and we look at my clock, my watch, and say, now it's 3:30. I'm tech up right now. It take only 10 minutes to get to Long Thanh, 16 miles, you know. So how my family can get there? Because when I told my family is the minute we got the airplane, I call home to my brother, say, leave the home right now. So I never know how many people and my family will leave with me on the trip. I don't know. I just tell my brother, just tell family leaving.
How many did you eventually have of your family?
After took off and after land Singapore, I know it. My family alone is 52, including me, is 53.
Okay.
And the three crew member is the major, the flight engineer, the loadmaster. Supposed to be four, but one of loadmaster, Jung. When I landed Long Thanh, he took off. Because after I saw the clock is too early to get them. So I tell my friend, my captain, hey, go slowly. Don't taxi too fast. So the other crew hear that in the phone, they thought, hey, maybe this is a new co-pilot, so he's very careful. And normally when we fly, I read the checklist real quick. But that time, I look at my checklist, I read line by line, word by word, to slow down, to buy up the time. So the other crew member hear that this one is so careful. He read the checklist so slow, you know. And so when we taxi to the end of the runway, I called tower for takeoff. They clear for takeoff, and we took off. You know what I do? The minute gear up, I turn up all the radio, transponder, blank. Just like we lost all electrical, content, no communication. Yeah. Yeah. Because the aircraft has a transponder, so the air traffic control on the ground know where we're going. But if I turn up the transponder, they just think, and they explain the radar, they thought just another helicopter or a small aircraft fly in the area, not C-130. And a friend of mine go normal speed, they say, slow down, man. We cannot fly fast because a radar may think it's C-130. If we go slow, they may think we're a helicopter or a small aircraft. So we go slow. And then during after takeoff, I make up story. I say, we're supposed to go to Phang Rang Air Force Base, right? Why the headquarter asked us to land at Long Thanh to pick up these people for? Because I know the airport had the special force station there in the end of the runway. They not control the runway, but they control the area. And I know the special force commander name. So I spell out the name of that commander so all the crew may hear that. So if we land in Long Thanh, somebody asks, what you land here for? Who you pick up? And he may say, yeah, I pick up your commander. I make up, okay? And everybody believe that. So after I came to Long Thanh and looked out through the runway, there's nobody there. My family is not there. Only 16 miles, but because the 1,000 people from the north of Vietnam or central refugee came to Saigon for safety. So like the freeway clock up. So they take them maybe 45 minutes to get to Long Thanh Airport. So I told my friend that, why don't you make another circling above the airport? So he make the circling. Second time I saw a small car traveling the dirt strip heading to the airport. So I told my friend, go ahead and land. So we land to the west, okay, and turn around 180 degrees. And I told my loadmaster, can you upload all the 20,000 pounds for me here? He is the master surgeon. He know exactly what went on, but he never asked me, Lieutenant, this cargo is supposed to go to Phang Rang. Why don't you ask me to upload here? He never asked that question. He unlocked it because he unlocked the safety. And he say, move forward. So when we move forward, all the cargo will be on the roller. We'll slide out to the ramp and sit there.
Slide out the back?
Yeah, because yeah. The back door is open.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to open the back door to load the cargo and upload the cargo.
Okay.
So after the aircraft move forward like 20 feet, all the cargo is dropped to the ground, sit there. Now, I already briefed my family that when you see the cargo off the airplane, run to the airplane. That's why the last minute I get up my seat. But before I get up my seat, I key the mic for everybody can hear. I say, gentlemen, this aircraft will not go back to Saigon. Whoever want to come with me, stay here. Who don't want to come with me, please leave this out this minute. So I saw my flight engineer sit next to me here. He unplugged his headset and he walked to the door. He go 3 steps. He come back and unplugged. I go with you. Now, this is a funny story. The master surgeon bring his student the first time in C-130 to train that loadmaster. First time, okay? So the master surgeon here, I say that he unplugged his headset and run away from the airplane. Now, by that time when we land, there was the Jeep belonged to the special force from the, they came on the runway. They run toward me. And I saw they put the M80, the grenade launcher. I don't think they intend to shoot at us, but the way he hold it and put the gun again the wall of the Jeep. Looked like he pointed to ready to shot, but it's not. I don't think so.
Okay.
Okay. So they saw the aircraft with 4 engines running. They don't approach. They park to the rear of the aircraft about 50 yards. So the master sergeant, load master, run toward them. The student still stand on the ramp and look toward his master. Say, why you don't come back? Well, you run over there, he teacher will come back, but it's not. He ran for good. So after I say that, I run to the back of the aircraft and see what's going on. And I saw the last the last people in it, the grandmother of my, the mother-in-law of my sister, she is like 86 years old. He goes slowly, you know. It's just so my brother come and grab for her hand and pull to the aircraft. Now, at that time, the aircraft is start to moving. I have no headset because I unplugged. And then look like my brother on the back of the yell at front at people on board already. So the aircraft moving. And I saw that second, the student loadmaster sitting and standing in the ramp, look at his boss. I lift the switch, lift him up. He on the ground like this. I hold the switch, lift up, and I call him. So I point to him so he understand. He come and lift the switch off, and then I run to the my seat. The minute I sit down, ready to get up because aircraft the airborne.
So how many total people were on the plane?
56.
Okay, that's it.
Yes.
And there was plenty of room?
Oh, plenty of room. I carry 200-300 people all the time.
When you took off, were you flying lower, slower?
Yeah, very low, very low. Atop the tree, because in this, there's no mountain, no tall tree, just as, you know, like on the flat level, wet, and then, the tree low. So we fly at the top of the tree, toward the ocean, like 20 miles, to get the ocean. And then when we reach the ocean, I drop to sea level, like at 10 feet above the sea level, and keep flying to avoid radar. But the thing is, during the training, C-130 have called the Doppler radar for use for navigation. And the pilot don't teach how to use the system, okay? But I am the guy who have the different mind. During the training, the U.S. trained for the aircraft to Vietnamese Air Force. They train pilot, they train loadmaster, they train flight engineer, they train navigator to use the system for long range.
The Doppler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So during the training, they train the pilot, loadmaster, flight engineer, and navigator, same time in one flight for like 4 hours in the air. They train. So I only sit in my right seat for 2 hours. And then I get out. The other captain jump in and then fly for 2 hours. And during that time, I look at how to use the system. And I memorize all how to use that, how to set the waypoint, you know. And I memorize that one. So remember when I go to the aircraft early, check fuel. Mm-hmm. The second thing is I pull the circuit breaker from the APU to start the electrical for the aircraft. I pull the circuit. That circuit breaker sit in the corner, very hard to see. And that one don't pop by itself. It's for maintenance only. So when the flight engineer show up the aircraft, he do the pre-flight, he cannot start that APU. It take him half an hour. The reason I do that for delay the time to leaving the main base, you know. And then after he find out he pulled the seat back on, and he just, maintenance, why don't you pull my leg up? Why don't you check the aircraft you put back for me? I don't waste too much time to do this, you know. It's so funny, you know. So after I pull the circuit breaker, I sit at the table up now and set all the waypoint real fast. Waypoint 1, waypoint 2, waypoint 4, waypoint 3, and the Singapore. Because we had to fly zigzag on the ocean, avoid some island stationed by Navy. So I planned all that one. So we don't fly straight line.
Yeah.
I go zigzag on the ocean.
And you flew to?
Singapore. Yeah.
Approximately how many miles?
I think it's 20 minutes, something like that. 2 hours, 20 minutes.
2 hours, 20 minutes.
Something like that.
Maybe 600 miles or...
No, more than that. More
700 than that. Maybe?
Yeah, 700.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you landed in Singapore, what did they think when you landed there?
Oh, I tell you the story when we land in Singapore. Now, a friend of mine didn't know where he's going. I said, just follow. Whatever I said in Doppler, and they automatic pop, and you just follow that and fly. So we fly for 1 hour in the ocean. And I tell you, I did go back on the airplane in the back to see how my people, my wife and two kids, look like. And the first one I saw with my dad, he is a pastor. He's sitting in the corner. Number one, I see his face is so afraid. Number two, I can read to his mind that he is with his son, stolen the aircraft from the Air Force. So he feel guilty by go along with his son, you know? And I see he's afraid and I can read his mind. And then another thing, because we fly so low for an hour, the air conditioning on the aircraft cannot fill all the water. So in the back of the cargo compartment, filled with fog. And the C-130 is like 8 feet apart. These people sit in this wall, cannot see the people sit near the wall. All the fog build up. I have the hard time to walk to go in the rear.
Sure.
And I actually don't know how many people on that airport at that time.
When you landed in Singapore, where did you go from Singapore?
In my approach chart that I open it for frequency, I can call approach and call control, call tower to for landing. So I call approach first, like 100 miles before I call, but nobody answer. I don't just like I do in Vietnam. If I go to Da Nang, 100 miles away, I call them. I say, hey, this is Hucky's 4-6-0, request landing instruction. And then they take you to like 20 miles, they land approach, and then another 10 miles, they hand me with the tower.
Mm-hmm.
So I call the other number, nobody answer. I hear them, but they don't answer me. So I switch to the tower, and I call Singapore Tower. This is Hucky 460 request landing instruction. I call exactly just like I call in Vietnam,
sure.
You know, in regular mission. And the tower report to me, Hucky 460, you clear to landing runway 02 right. Wind at 360 at 5 knot, altimeter setting, temperature right now, set. They tell me exactly what I hear because they're international, so people say the same word for all the tower to all the aircraft. So they clear me to land runway 02. Then I told my friend, yeah, runway 02. You see it? So come back and we land. After we land, the tower said, oh, 460, you taxi to the block Bravo in the left side. You hear that? So I said, yeah, I see the spot. So we pull to the spot. Now it's 46 years. I still not understand. When I pull to that spot on the ground, that is civilian airport, okay? Civilian airport, not military airport. I saw the MD-3, U.S. Air Force power supply, already start with the light, two men stand by. The minute he make a signal for us to stop, the guy pulled the power from the MD-3 to the aircraft. He opened the door. He plucked the electrical to my airplane. He saluted me and he walked away. Number one, how he know this is C-130? How he know where is the plug to plug that plug on? Should be Air Force people too close to C-130. You know why the civilian airport has the MD-3 Air Force sit there and waiting for me to, because I just called them like 10 minutes before. How he have enough time to pull that aircraft, the power supply there and ready to plug in my airplane.
So when they had you all get off of the airplane, what?
When do that, myself, my friend, my brother, three of us get out of the aircraft and I tell my people, don't ever leave the aircraft. Just sit here.
Okay.
And we are electrical, so we turn all the light on. Okay? So we walk into the main terminal and I saw all the Asian from the immigration do all the paperwork for Pan Am, just did land there. And we walk in the back and I saw a couple guys, so we don't bother ask them. So I went to the top of the tower, to the room, and I saw so many monitor, so I can see everywhere in the airport. And the guy who in charge sit on the his seat and read the newspaper. And we knocked the door, and I didn't say much. My brother do all the communication, because he good better English than me, you know. So he said, excuse me. We are South Vietnam Air Force. We just land here and we want to seek political asylum. I cannot talk to your boss. He say, you're a crap part over there. I saw it. Yeah. But sorry, my boss is go home. Our office open from 9 to 5. If you want to talk to my boss, why don't you go to the hotel gate there and stay there and tomorrow come back here and see my boss? I say, what? You cannot have it. By any pride, I need to see you, talk to your high ranking here at the airport. So he say, okay, I try. Go back to your airplane and wait. So we walk back to the airplane. And I hear the hymn song, Psalm 23. I say, what? Why don't you sing this song? So I walk to the rear of the aircraft, the rear open. And I saw the cradle of Coke, milk, fruit, cake, the whole ram up to C-130. It's bigger than this area, maybe twice. And I asked my people, so what this came from? He say, yeah, when your guy gone, the airline people from that terminal come out and saw us hungry, no food, no drink, so they have the forklift bring all the food level from the airline to give to us. You know, to give to us. So all the kids enjoy all the food, cake and fruit and drink all they want, you know. Mm. And then we stay there until one in the morning. 20 police truck surrounding the aircraft. We're police chief, and then we run down and talk to them. I say the same thing. The Vietnamese counselor also happened there. And we met him and said, yeah, I want to congratulate you because you had to run like me. You hear from here, you maybe just took off to friend, to whatever you want. But for us, we run away from communists to look political asylum. That reason I'm here. Can you do something to help us? I say, okay, I will. But when the police chief asked us same question, we said, yeah, we want to seek political asylum here in Singapore. So they say, the prime minister is the one who gives authority, but he away from this country to go out for different country visit for 2 weeks. So why don't you take up and go somewhere else? Don't bother us. I say, okay, I want to go to Australia, but my chart end up in Singapore. Can you give me the chart from here to Australia? I say, yeah, we can give you. And fuel is maybe half. We need the full fuel. How much you need? Blah, blah. He calculation that $5,000.
Ooh.
So I run to the aircraft and say, yeah, they need money to pay for fuel. You have any money? No money.
No money.
So yeah. I put my golden watch and put it in the box, and my mother take out the ring. And whoever gets some jewelry, put it out, diamond ring, put it in there, and I take it. This one is worth maybe $5,000. He said, no, cash only. This junk, we don't take it, you know. Yeah. So after that, they had the meeting, and they come back. Okay, we don't know what to do, but we will keep you here for a while. And then waiting for the prime minister to come back, and he make decision. Even we help you to get out of here, we keep you here, or we send your guy back to Vietnam. Okay? That's what they say. So whatever you want to do. But right now, I am in the free country. I'm happy. You jail us, we're still happy. You know? And then they have the doctor came and asked, any one of you have the medical record? They say, what is that? We never hear that in our life. You know? Say, you mean you can have shot? But my four nephew, He studied in the American school. So he got the record to bring with him. So, okay, this guy good. The rest of you, they came and give us all the shot and, you know, doctor check, make sure we don't bring disease to the... Yeah, that's okay because they're duty. We had to do that. And then after that, they take us on the prisoner carry bus and fly drive for 2 hours. I don't know where to go. And then after they came to the building that was the rehab for the drug people, maybe 3, 4 in the morning. So they kicked a couple guys on the floor, and then they give us the mat. And then the lady with the kids stay upstairs, and the man, teenagers, stay in on the lower level. And then they bring food for us right away. They say, you guys hungry, so we have prisoner food. And they say, well, thank you. We go eat the airport already. We can eat that prisoner food, you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that we stay in that, they call detention center or something. But they don't let us, any outsider contact us.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep so secret. They say, yeah, we don't want to disturb the newspaper that came and then bother your guy and maybe not too good.
From there, how is it that you made it to the United States?
Because I picked Singapore because I know they need pilot. So I, friend of my pilot, my two brother also pilot, one for Air Vietnam, one for the Air Force. And me, it's four. And we have four English teachers on board, two pastors. And we done the thug to let them scare them, but we all good people. They know that. The funny thing is when we go to jail, and every night before we eat, we pray, and we at night we sing, and we have the prayer meeting. And the chief jailer looked through the window. They came to my brother. I dispatched my brother is the contact outside and everybody, I don't say a word, you know. So the chief jailer said, you know what? You're a Christian. I know because you guys sing hymn song every night. I'm a Christian too. You want to have a pastor come and preach for you? Yeah, thank you. You can bring it on, but we have two here already, you know. And thing is, very good for us, this. I left Saigon at 4 p.m. Mean 4 o'clock New York time. We land at Singapore at about 7:30 at dark. An hour later at New York, no. New York mean the U.S. government already know. But the superintendent, American superintendent of Christian in Vietnam, called New York. He said, there was C-130 flown off Saigon. Inside that aircraft are Christian and two pastors. Can your guy in New York do something? And at that time, Pastor Richard Pendale, in charge for work relief, he hear that in his office. And he pound his hand on the table and say, I know, that was Kim, because he know me from Vietnam. My wedding, he gave me some gift. And 1970, when I training in Lockbourne Air Force Bay, I came to his home every weekend to eat. His wife cooked Vietnamese food for us. He know me then. Now he is the president of Work Relief. So he has plenty of money.
Another miracle.
Yes. He used money to support Africa anywhere they need. The minute he hear that, he say, I know one lawyer in Singapore. I know one businessman in Singapore. I will contact them right away. So the next, within 24 hours, he sent $20,000 Singapore to the lawyer, say, by any price, you don't let Singapore go and send this group back to Vietnam. To his business partner, he said, you treat these people well. Don't let them eat the prisoner food. So 2 days later, the jailer came in and say, from today on, you guys don't have to eat prisoner food anymore. But any kind of food you want us to go to market, buy it, we buy for you and bring it home. All the women go to kitchen and cook. So we, the third day we eat all the good food, you know, don't have to eat terrible food, junk food anymore. The minute I came to Singapore, the most scary is my son only 5 months old. My wife don't have a meal to feed him. And we have the one little powder, small, maybe last for 2 days. How we feed the baby. The third day, they bring in about 4 or 5 can of milk powder, like each of them like weight for maybe 5 pounds or 10 pounds, I don't know. They bring it in, more than we need. All the 5-6-year-old kid come and just eat that raw powder, you know. They bring in egg and fruit. We in jail, but we not in jail, which is...
Like, it was good.
Oh, yeah. Only thing is we had to slap at the floor. and the mosquito bite us every night. You know, no thing cover us, and then that's the only thing. But we have good food, and every 3 days they let the lady came down to join the family and have the prayer meeting, and then go back out. And then every day 5 o'clock we all go out to the open area, like soccer field, and we can walk around and talk, and you know. Yeah. And then every day they send doctor every day in the morning and in evening if any sick people they take care. And one of my friend engineer have a tooth problem, so he said, okay, we send you the dentist. Here's the funny part. He complained with me a couple of days ago that his middle end here is hurt. So he just, I don't know, can stand. So he sent the dentist in. The dentist is from India. He give lanacane to my friend engineer and pull the teeth out. So at night, the engineer wake up and say, oh, how come they pull the teeth still hurt? So he puts his hand in his teeth and say, the bad teeth still here. They pulled the good teeth away from me.
Oh, no.
That's so funny, you know. So I had to complain. The next day, the same dentist in and pulled the bad teeth out. So he lost 2 teeth in one day, you know. Well, we stayed there 19 days. Wow. And the end of 19 days, the jailer came in and said, pack up. Your guy will go to a different country. And I didn't know what different country is. And we go back to the same bus they took us from the airport. And they drove for another 2 hours. And they parked at the pier. And there was the boat, the cruise dinner boat already parked at the pier. So we all 56 carry our small bag and then walk to the boat. And they drive for another 1 hour, 2 hours. To the island. This is the resort island. Now we go in and all the white bed cover, 5-star hotel.
They say, talk about extremes.
They say all the food in the kitchen. Go out and cook whatever you want. Right. That afternoon, the deputy of interior carry with him 5 more people walk with him to that resort island to visit us. The first thing what he say, he apologize us for keep us for last night in the jail. How we illegal immigrant came here and they apologize us. We support apologize to Singapore government, but he came. He carry 1 case of champagne, 3-5 tray of all the fruit, candy and cake and wrap in the red paper, the traditional of the people when you're wedding. You have to wrap all the food and on the red paper. 3 tray and give to us. So you have enjoy all this when you stay here. You believe that?
It's pretty astounding.
Oh, yeah. And then they lap and we all the kid enjoy all that candy or the fruit and the cake. And whoever can drink champagne, go ahead and take maybe 2 bottles or so they drink, you know. And the next day, they come back, say, pack up, you have to leave now. We go back to the same boat, and they take us to the airport. When they're reaching the airport, I look to the terminal. I say, if I see the Air Vietnam 727 part there, that means we send back to Vietnam. But it's not. I saw the Pan Am park and the tarmac and the bus to carry us back up to the entrance for the first class. So we all sit the first class. And the people who buy the ticket go to U.S. all sit in the economy section. And we all sit in the first class.
Wow.
Now, so we know we not go back to Vietnam, you know. All they say is, we'll take you guys to San Francisco. That's all we know. Okay. Yeah. Then they've flown for like a 4-hour across the ocean and land in Guam for fuel, I think. Mm-hmm. And then after Guam, they fly another 150 miles to Saipan Island. the resort area. And the captain came to us and he said, I worked for Pan Am for 20 years. I never received any order like this. We carry passengers from Singapore to Guam for refuel. From Guam, we fly direct to San Francisco. But now all the paid passengers had to get off Guam. I had to carry 56 you guys to Saipan Island and drop your guy there and come back here and pick up these people who got flown to San Francisco. He said, I never received that order before. Now, we land at Saipan about 3 in the morning. It's dark. At the airport, I saw a lot of people there because the light shined to the aircraft. I looked there. I don't see the face. I said, maybe some Vietnamese refugee already here. That means they came and looked for their relative something. But when we opened the door, we walked to the gate. I looked. No, they are not. They are local people. They're all dark and big, you know. Hawaiian people, something like that. And you know, that air people is very large size. And they keep looking at us, and we didn't know. We didn't say hi to them because we didn't know what's going on. So we go to the terminal. We didn't do any paperwork. Go to the bus and drop us at 5-star hotel again, Continental Hotel. We stay, and then we have what they say is, your guy will stay here for 2 weeks. And then after that, your guy will go direct to San Francisco. We'll have the big welcome over there. And during we stay there, 5-star hotel, you know what? They block one section just for 56 of us eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The people who pay 5-star hotels eat in different area. And they when we check in, they have 56 room already reserved for your guy. 56! Because they count the baby, count my family, four. They count four. But actually, we need only one room. And my father with two daughters, a younger daughter, don't need four rooms. Maybe one for them and one for kid. And suddenly, finally, we have like 15 or 12 rooms we need for all family to sit together. Yeah. And every day we enjoy, we eat breakfast, we eat lunch, dinner, and spare time we go to the beach and swimming there, just like we're on vacation. I know where the money came from because the $10,000 they give to us because later on I met Pastor Pandel here a couple of times and he said, because we know your guy stay in jail for 21 days, it's too hard for your guy, so we won't treat your guy, Saipan Island.
People can be good.
Yeah. And the pastor, a Baptist pastor came. We don't have the money. So he gave each of us 10 U.S. dollar, you know, so we can go to the store, buy some clothes and thing, you know. Later, and I find out who is the people 3 in the morning came to the airport and see us. One of the lady there, she is Vietnamese there. She know. She said, no. That people is local people. They hear on the radio news that tomorrow night there was a group of Vietnamese refugees who came and stay here for 2 weeks to look to see how the Vietnamese look like.
Oh.
That's why they there.
To see what they look like. That's funny.
Yeah, it's funny.
Well, maybe it wasn't funny to you, but I think that sounds funny.
Yeah, because I walk out, we didn't know what they are. So we just walk to the terminal. And if they say hi to us, maybe we just say hi back. But they just look at us and we just walk away, you know. Now, we're supposed to stay for 2 weeks. But we stayed only one week. There was a reporter from Pacific News came. Mm-hmm. And they didn't ask me. They asked my sister, my brother. Say, you do the job relation, not me. I take your guy out of Vietnam. That's all my duty. Not for me. All you got to do it. So my brother, sister tell her exactly what we do. Now, on the article, they didn't say anything bad about us. But the article, a large article, said this. Why a couple thousand Vietnamese people, refugees, stay in the 10 horrible 10, just like the Mexican now living in the 10 in border. And here is 56 people living in luxurious hotel, question mark. The ambassador at the island read that article, say, oh, something is not right here. The next day, you got to pack up. Okay, we pack up. We go to the Continental Airline, fly to Guam. They dump us at Guam and go to the refugee camp just like anybody else. And I stay there maybe 5 days and for processing and go to U.S. After that, go to Camp Pendleton camp. And then the funny part is when I saw my commander, he also just get from Thailand to Guam. He met me and said, Kim, you're supposed to go out with me. Why don't you call the other guy? I said, well, if I tell you, you put me in jail, you know. But actually, when I, later on, I came to this country, I met a lot of friends, commander, high ranking. Every single one of them had the same idea, just like me. But they don't have any gut to do it. They don't have opportunity to do it. But everything happened to me, it's just like thing arranged before, like a movie. People tell me, oh, you just think you're already aware of them and you sit here and bullshit too much, you know, but it's not. Whatever happened, I tell the truth. You believe me or not, that's your, not me. But I tell the truth, you know? Because if I tell lies, something will happen, you know?
I understand. Well, was it difficult for you to settle in the United States? The people that you encountered, were they good, bad to you, or some, maybe not?
Oh, 99% was all good people.
Yeah.
You know, I was sponsored by the pastor of San Diego in May 75, after I stayed in the refugee camp Pendleton for like 15 days for processing.
Mm-hmm.
And then my in-law was sponsored by Fairhaven Church in Dayton. Now, my wife is only one daughter in the family. And my two grandchildren, the first grandkid, they have the family. Now, we go to refugee camp after split. They go to Ohio. I'm here in San Diego. And they so much worry about our living in San Diego. So, well, I'm a Christian. The pastor came and grabbed me and welcomed me and support me and everything I need, you know. I would treat so well. I don't ever short money or food, anything. Yeah. We all supply. And then my father-in-law asked if we can move to Ohio. At that time, I worked at the airport, pumping gas in the airplane. April, I was a pilot. May, I was a gas boy, pumping gas in the airport for small airplane. You know? Make a $2.10 per hour, and each gallon I pump gas, they only give me 1 cent extra. So I make a 2 hour and 50 cents per hour, something like that. You know.
How many children do you have?
Three. But at that time, only two.
Okay.
So when we moved to Ohio,
boy, girl.
My daughter is two when I left.
Okay.
My son is 5 months.
Okay.
Now when we moved to Ohio here. Rebecca was born here at Date in 76, a year later.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. So right now I have three kids and 9 grandchildren.
How did your children do? Did they get an education, good jobs? I mean, how did they do?
Oh, sure. Sure, look at Becca.
Tell me about them.
So they went to school here. When they baby just like any American kid, 5 years ago to, you know.
Kindergarten
growing up. And
sure.
Then only thing happened to my family that I have a job to fly a year later. I fly instructor and then make my way up. Everything has happened miracle. You know, so many thousand Vietnamese came here, pilot, none of them flying. And when we came, applied for flying, there was surplus of pilot from the war end. So many pilot retired. American pilot retired, and they also apply for the job, too. How can I, minority, can compete with them? But the airline have the policy that 10% had to be minority. Then I was fit 10%. And then that's why I was hired by a Piedmont airline, you know.
And you had to be able to fly difficult missions.
Yeah. The funny thing is, my aircraft laid on pickup and put in Smithsonian, but somehow it not work because of some political happened. So now that my aircraft at New York National, the small airfield, and they repaint exactly what the when I take the aircraft out, they have the Vietnam Air Force marking. Now they put in the display, they will repaint exactly. They don't make any.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
You have? Yeah. Have you been in it?
Yeah, so it's at the National Warplane Museum in Geneseo, New York, and we were able to go there a couple months ago, even during the pandemic. So I got to sit in the cockpit of the plane with my dad for the first time.
Yeah, 45 years.
All of the grandkids got to sit in the cockpit with grandpa. It was just neat to see, like, the plane with all these buttons, and you didn't even know where to start. And we were like, there's paper maps. Like, that's how they did things back in the day. There's not Siri telling you where to turn. So the kids were just really amazed, and just how big the C-130 airplane was, that it was amazing that this miracle could even happen.
I would say they're special moments, but they're beyond special moments. That's once-in-a-lifetime feeling.
Oh, yeah. I never expect that one.
The
but
feeling.
Somehow the curator at Smithsonian found me, and then they say, you are the first aircraft get out of Vietnam by air after the war end. That's why your aircraft have pickup to put in Smithsonian. They sit at the on the outside for maybe 30 years. Funny thing, when I fly to Dulles Airport, we take up on the 3-4, we go to the end of the south, and the other fin, I can see my aircraft part, full engine part there. I used to tell the pilot, let me say, that my airplane. He looked at it, well, he expects that was Cessna, small Cessna or something. I said, no, that's C-130. He said, why? Why your aircraft? I said, because I bring it out of Vietnam, you know.
That's how I got here.
I hear that now, I see the aircraft. So anytime, they don't fly with me. If they happen to take off that same runway, they only point to the other guy. Say, that Kim, C-130, you know.
Kim Phan, you are a very lucky man.
Yes.
And I know that you believe that. And you have told me already you believe in miracles. And certainly more than one took place in your journey from April 75 to where you are today. And you've had many years to think about this, but I want to ask you a final question. Life here in America is good.
Yes.
When it comes to communism, you have seen what that is all about.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison, correct?
Right. Sure, no.
Kim, Rebecca, I want to thank you both for joining me today, and I have enjoyed speaking with you. You know, I think it's a consensus that people would say war is hell, without exception. And people around the world are just people with different sets of challenges. We may speak many different languages. We may live with unique customs and beliefs. Yet we are all alike in that we seek the same basic things in life. Food, shelter, safety, family, love and understanding, and the freedom to enjoy every day to its fullest. Listeners, may I suggest that you share this show with your friends. Simply copy and post the link for this program directly onto your social media platforms. Our media network operates with a dedicated team of 35 individual show hosts around the country. We have 80 syndication partners and 17 different media domain platforms. Our studios provide targeted on-demand media programming for over 3,300 small communities around the country. Audio Adventurist is a show format we offer across the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. On our show, we strive to bring you unique and interesting topics and the guests to go with them. We sincerely thank PuzzleFunds.org for sponsoring and supporting this program today. If you find that you have a specific question or a comment for us, email us anytime 24/7, shout@theflypod.com. Well, I have been your host, Gary Puckett, and you have been listening to Audio of Interest. So until our next episode, we thank you for joining us and listening in here on the flypod.com New Media Network.